If we look at all the jobs that are advertised in the ESG space now, it's all about ESG compliance, ESG reporting. It's not about people actually going off and doing ESG.
I think almost all of it is pointless. If I think about what would actually make the difference, it would be facilitating innovation, so more money into early stage tech.
I've always been skeptical about too much regulation. I don't think investors create value by filling out forms. They do that by allocating capital wisely. The industry has really overregulated, and that we have turned ESG into a compliance industry.
Welcome to Sustainability Wired, the show that plugs into the thinking that moves sustainable finance. I'm Lorenzo Sa, the Chief Sustainability Officer at Clarity AI, and I'm really excited today to cover the topic of how sustainability is looking like today in the current headwinds. How does the PRI fit in this, the Principles for Responsible Investment, and how does the future of that organization look like because of where we are today? And then thirdly is, what is the role of AI in taking this industry forward? I'm delighted today to have two guests that I think are spot on for the topic. It's the two former executive directors of the PRI, and they also were my two direct line managers when I worked at the PRI for 14 years. So with that, welcome James and Fiona.
Thanks, Lorenzo.
Thanks, Lorenzo. Looking forward to the discussion.
Look, I was trying to think of how I was going to introduce the two of you, and I looked at your CV and I said, this is going to be impossible to go through the entire list. So I'm going to actually give you the work to do it by basically asking you to highlight a little bit of what was your role at the PRI and in what circumstances you got there, as well as then flag what you're doing today and what are the main things you want to highlight in the terms of your career up to now. James, I'll have you kick off.
So in 2003, as an intern, I went to the UN Environment Programme's Finance Initiative, working with Paul Clements Hunt, and came up with the idea of developing a set of principles focused on the pension funds around sustainability. And Paul hired me to take that idea forward. Working with colleagues, we ran a drafting process over 2005, and then we launched in 2006. I became the first employee and built the organization up over the subsequent 7 or so years. And at the same time, I did a PhD on shareholder engagement. And then after the PRI, I set up a course on impact investing for ultra high net worth inheritors, which I still teach. And then spent 8 years in private banking in impact investing for UBS and Credit Suisse.
Great. Thanks, James. Fiona.
Okay. So, well, I came to the PRI and became the CEO, following on from James, a very hard act to follow, I must say. And I was there for about 9.5 years acting in the role. I then decided pretty much after COVID, really, that I'd been in London for, 9.5 years. I was always planning to come home. But I think when you live as an expat overseas, you sort of do so on the basis that you can get back into your own country. And when you can't, it kind of changes the way that you feel. Plus, I felt really burnt out after all of the time at the PRI. It's a hard job. And I decided it was time to come back to Australia. Now, Australia is a much smaller market than obviously London, etc. So I decided not to try to replicate what I was doing in London, but to take a different tact. And so I started working in a non-executive role, so doing non-executive positions. So in Australia, I chair a pension fund, so I've got a sort of asset owner lens. I chair an ESG committee for a small fund manager that's a private credit fund. I sit on the Sustainability Council for a large US-based fund manager as well. I'm the president of FAIR, and I am on the board of an asset consulting firm, and I also am the chair of the UN Global Compact here in Australia, and I'm on the board of the Australian Sustainable Finance Institute. So very much still work in the pensions and the responsible investment space just on this side of the world, but I have some international things that I do as well. So I sort of have the best of both worlds.
As you're in Australia, it explains the dark space behind you compared to those on this side of the world. James, where are you?
I'm in Zug in Switzerland.
All right. So two of you passed each other the baton and brought the PRI to till relatively recently. But you probably didn't expect or you didn't see what was coming in the times that you have both left since, in the sense that if we look at where sustainable investment is today, I think there's, you know, call it ESG backlash or headwinds, things in the last few years have seen pretty rocky. ESG funds have been outflowing, especially in certain markets. There's political backlash of different sorts, depending on where you sit. A number of players have left net zero initiatives, and some net zero initiatives don't even exist as they were designed per se. And the regulation has grown, has become more complex, and it's probably been diverging more recently across different geographies. So, to kick off, I'd really like to get a sense of your views of the market today. And maybe I'll kick off with you, James. You know, if you look at this, do you feel that this is all about external forces, or has it in a way been self-inflicted by us as we have been over-promising more than what we can actually achieve?
Yeah, so I think the downturn for ESG or the backlash, it's a result of a perfect storm of many, many different factors. And the most important factor is financial performance, right? Anytime sustainable investing products underperform, there will be huge outflows. That's just a reality. And a lot of people piled into stocks which were pro-COVID cyclicals. For example, we had strategies around digital healthcare and education, and they absolutely tanked after COVID as everyone went back to their doctor and went back to the classroom. Then there was the invasion of Ukraine. This obviously caused fossil fuel prices to spike. Share prices of fossil fuels went up, which meant people without fossil fuels underperformed, at least for some time. But not only was it just the financial piece, it was also people recognized, the end of history is no longer, and we have serious global geopolitical issues, and maybe these ESG things are a nice to have, and we've got like serious problems with energy prices in Europe, with losing pipelines, whatever it is, and I think that made a difference. Interest rates were a shock to any companies whose cash flows are further out in time, obviously got hammered. A lot of clean tech companies, a small cap, et cetera. So they got hit really hard. And then I think to some degree, there was overreach in the sustainable investing activist community when it comes to perhaps DEI and also pushing some companies on climate change where it just wasn't compatible with the business model. There was always going to be pushback. And then you had obviously Republicans in the US taking advantage of that and really blowing it up into a big anti-ESG campaign.
Okay, so it's primarily around the financial element, though the geopolitics have somewhat frame things to enhance that. And would you imagine that there could be a counter-cyclical effect where those shifts change for the advantage? And if so, would sustainability come back to where it was before? Or do you think the scene has changed in a way that that counter-cyclical would not look the same?
Look, I think, you know, 10 or 15 years of really cheap money meant that there are a lot of nice-to-haves which people were able to jump on board. I think unless we see that kind of cheap money again, it all depended on low interest rates or really low cost of capital. So I think we'll really struggle to see some of those businesses that relied on low interest rates coming back quickly anytime soon. But, you know, there will be some
some sectors, I'm sure, which will benefit from different parts of the cycle.
And Fiona, maybe do you see any specific trend that have actually impacted how we got to in sustainable investment? And maybe specifically, have you, on the climate side, do you feel that there's that we chose the wrong time or the wrong way to tackle it?
Yeah, well, look, Lorenzo, I mean, I often hear people say that responsible investment is at a crisis point or it's at an inflection point. I'm not sure I completely agree with that. I do think that when I speak to people, particularly internationally, I come away with the feeling that the industry, the responsible investment industry, feels stuck and sort of unsure of its direction. Where are we going? What do we do next? I mean, in the US, of course, ESG has got caught up in the culture wars. And in Europe, you know, there's frustration about too much regulation, not enough clarity around outcomes. So I think that we've wanted accountability, but we've really risked creating a compliance industry instead of building resilience. I think some of that's external politics, but some of us, I think, is on us. ESG, to me, has become too much about labels and compliance, not about outcomes. The risks haven't gone away, though, and I think there's still a challenge now in how we shift from sort of this growth at any cost mentality to quality growth and investment that delivers return and reduces systemic risks at the same time. And the urgency of getting ourselves unstuck is really undeniable. You know, carbon emissions hit another record high last year, inequality still widening, there's conflict across the world, all of these things that are systemic risks. But I think that at the same time, we need to look at the success. And I do think that rather than responsible investment failing, some of the backlash is actually because it's been successful, because we have made real and measurable progress. You know, ESG and sustainability and climate risks are much more embedded in capital allocation decisions than 10, 15 years ago. We've got material risk factors, transition planning, disclosure and standards are much better managed for large asset owners and management. Anytime there's volatility and changes in policy and major transitions that are underway, that there are backlashes, there's course corrections. I don't think that means that responsible investment's going to end. I do think, however, and I feel strongly about this, that the industry has really overregulated, and that we have turned ESG into a compliance industry. And, you know, I don't think investors create value by filling out forms. They do that by allocating capital wisely. And I think we need rules that drive clarity and accountability, but not red tape that, you know, just crowds out decision making. And I read industry news like Responsible Investor, and all I ever read about, which drives me crazy, is the EU omnibus, CSRD, SFRD. I don't hear any discussion about actual ESG issues anymore, and that frustrates me a great deal. I do want to just touch on this issue, though, that you said about climate, Lorenzo, because I would absolutely argue the opposite. I think that we should have started on climate much earlier and pushed much harder. We're going into New York Climate Week. We're 10 years from Paris. And whilst there's absolutely been progress that's been made and investors have played a role, you know, at the time of the Paris Agreement, we're on track for 4 degrees. We're now somewhere between, 2.5 and 2.8, depending on what you look at. So I still believe that the net zero goal has been correct. I do think, though, that we have to accept that we're not keeping the world to 1.5 degrees, and investors really need to be changing their focus to attention on adaptation and mitigation efforts and allocating more capital and resources, not just to renewables, but really to climate solutions. And just finishing up on that, in terms of the net zero alliances, I mean, when I was at the PRI with Unipify, we started the Net Zero Asset Owners Alliance. To me, it's a high ambitions, highly credible net zero example of investors, a small group of leaders working together to drive things forward. And I think it's been a great success.
Yes, there's a lot there, Fiona. Maybe I'll double click on a couple with James. James, this issue of regulation, has it helped us or has it harmed us?
Look, I think it has harmed us. It's been, you know, a number of years that I came to this conclusion, you know, because I would have 10 years ago been gung-ho for all of what the EU proposed and has implemented. I now think almost all of it is a complete mistake. And the reason is, number one, there is no additionality lens in anything the EU has done. There is nowhere that says, if all of this regulation actually is implemented, more capital will actually flow to the things we want it to flow to. That it's their theory, but there was absolutely no way that that was going to happen given how badly drafted this regulation is. The problem is that they felt that, you know, if we get everybody to disclose things, then money will flow in the right direction. The problem is that they didn't understand that in public markets, highly efficient markets, there is no additionality in money flowing towards, say, clean tech stocks. It markets are efficient enough that if some investors crowd into some stock, other investors will crowd out and go into something else. And markets are relatively efficient. And the EU regulation actually makes it harder to do private market investments. It creates huge bureaucracies. I saw at the banks the number of people involved in implementing SFDR and other EU sustainability regulation was literally 10x the number of people doing private market impact fund investments. And that is absolutely outrageous. And I saw over the years less innovation. I saw more ass covering, to be honest, box ticking, and all of the headcounts that remain at these banks after this shakeout are all regulatory and compliance headcounts in ESG, you know, fearing greenwashing, et cetera. The other point I'd like to make about, you know, how incompetent the EU has been in this regulation is, let's think about the problem that they're actually trying to solve for. Greenwashing, supposedly some really terrible thing. Okay, the worst example of greenwashing is, for example, a tobacco stock in an ESG ETF. Shock horror. What actual difference does it make to the world if it's there or not? Absolutely nothing. They're literally protecting the virtue signaling of the investor. It makes no difference whether that tobacco stock is in or out. It shows a fundamental misunderstanding of efficient markets. And if there's one thing that we don't need from a nanny state, it's to tell people which stocks or not are more ethical or less ethical or whatever. Surely that is one area of the economy where buyer beware is an absolutely legitimate thing, instead of a buyer beware, which is basically free of charge and people can take their own responsibility. We have a massive bureaucracy with literally hundreds, if not thousands, of headcount absolutely wasting money, removing the opportunity for innovation, marketing, product development, etc.
If you had the opportunity to overwrite all regulations, all it now, today, gone, would you still keep some? I mean, TCFD, stewardship reporting, you know, CO2 emissions, are any of those valuable? Or were you like, look, we're good. The investors can deal with what they need to do. Materiality will be found. And that's more than enough.
I think almost all of it is pointless. Now, that's a big call to make. But if I think about what would actually make the difference, it would be facilitating innovation. So more money into early stage tech. I mean, we need to reduce the price of batteries by at least 95% if we're to have grid stability with renewables. We need to remove regulation from the nuclear industry, which is way over-regulated. And we need to fix cross-border marketing. We need to allow retail investors to invest in illiquid impact strategies somehow. I mean, the biggest chunk of assets from retail investment, they're literally not even allowed to invest in early stage venture capital. I mean, you know, they're allowed to buy a restaurant or buy a Ferrari, but you can't actually invest in a solid VC strategy. It's against the law. And so everything they've done has actually added more sand in the gears, and they haven't removed anything that actually might help facilitate capital into the most impactful areas of the economy.
Fiona, you were jumping in.
Yeah, I just wanted to add, look, I think following on from what James said, look, if we look at all the jobs that are advertised in the ESG space now, it's all about ESG compliance, ESG reporting. It's not about people actually going off and doing ESG. I think to me, I've always been skeptical about too much regulation. It's not something that I've come to later after the EU created all of this. I've always been mindful that governments come and go, and therefore regulation can come and go. And what we should focus on in industry is on what we need to do. We don't need regulation for that. To me, a good example of this, though, was with the Biden era IRA. The IRA, I thought, was a great policy, trying to get and deploy capital out the door into good, in some cases, startup, but into good projects. But then billions and billions and billions of dollars in seed investment didn't get out the door. It couldn't get deployed because it got caught up in red tape and bureaucracy. And I just think that is such a waste. I think, though, when it comes to like what would you keep and what wouldn't you, I'd keep high-level frameworks like TCFD, ISSB kind of climate reporting, because I think investors do need some useful information. I certainly keep carbon emission disclosure, so scope 1, scope 2, and material scope 3, because I think you do need to measure those things. On stewardship reporting, I'd say, well, why do we have to report to a regulator about stewardship? I mean, if I'm an asset owner and I've outsourced my stewardship, say, to a manager, then the manager should report to me about what they're doing, or if I use a voting service. But I don't know why you'd have to report to a regulator. And I think we need to rethink all this sort of layering of rules upon rules upon rules that create duplication and box ticking. For example, you know, the way that you've got SFDR, the EU taxonomy, CSRD, how they interact has just created too much of a compliance burden. But it's not really clear that anyone's getting better outcomes. I think keep the backbone of sort of global high-level standards, but fewer rules upon rules upon rules upon rules.
As we look forward, right, against the current headwinds, what is actually something constructive that we can do? Because regulations are going to somewhat exist in different fashions. So what is the alternative, or what are maybe aspects of resilience that you see in either regions, markets, or strategies that can help overcome the backlash instead of sitting and complaining in a certain sense around what the regulation is doing? James.
Look, I think this Ezra Klein and Derek Thompson book, Abundance, is a really good guide for the ESG industry. I think ESG needs an abundance moment and conversation. And that book really outlines how, you know, well-meaning bureaucracy actually just grinds things to a halt, and you can't actually build things for the people you want to serve. And I think investors should, read that book, but really internalize that philosophy that bureaucracy alone, reporting requirements, is not where we need to go. We need to build. We need to innovate. And in terms of specific sectors that I think are important, again, aligned with the arguments in that book, is energy abundance. You know, we need energy abundance. And I think a lot of the climate conversation over the last decade certainly hasn't been focused on energy abundance. It has had certainly a faction which has an energy scarcity mindset. And with AI, energy, and so on, we're just going to need a massive amount of energy. Ethiopia's per capita energy or electricity consumption is between 1 and 2% of Western countries. And it's 130 million people. To get up to where Western countries are now, you know, they're going to need, 100x amount of electricity. We have to work out where that's going to come from. And I think nuclear power is one area where we have to go full speed ahead. I think the price of batteries is still really far, far beyond what could be used to industrialize an entire economy like Ethiopia. So we have to have baseload coming from somewhere. I think nuclear is one. I think anything that supports grid stability is another important one. I think there's been an overbuild of renewables, and I think the blackouts in Spain are an obvious consequence of that. And we need a lot more investment in grid stability, which includes batteries and other forms of infrastructure.
So energy abundance, Fiona, is that's our way out of the crisis, or do you have anything else in mind?
I agree with most of what James said. I think, you know, investors have done a lot on investing in renewables, in clean tech, etc. Of course, there's more that needs to be done, but we now need to be turning our attention, I think, also to much more to emerging markets. Because I don't think that we cannot solve the climate issue that is a global issue that affects everybody. We can't solve inequality issues. We can't solve the big, big systemic issues unless we put more money into emerging and developing countries. And we have to find ways that make those markets, able to be invested in. And I think we should be turning our mind as a responsible investment industry into this. How do we really develop those markets?
So look, I think we're going to shift gears. PRI, it's celebrating 20 years. I think you both contributed to, I think, a lot of its successes. And I think there is a lot to celebrate. But I do think it's a moment which we can use to also look back and see what might be lessons learned, and look forward on how to actually make sure that the PRI continues to succeed. I'll kick off with you, Fiona, to say, look, we just talked about how much has changed in the PRI in the last few years. Do you think with all this regulation and all this shifting environment that the PRI as it is today is still valid? And do you think it should even keep existing?
Well, I think the PRI should absolutely still exist and is still needed. I mean, I feel really privileged to have been at the PRI for, you know, just under a decade, and I'm extremely attached to it, and I'll always be a cheerleader. I still think the principles are valid. They're just as valid today as when they were launched. I think what you do under those principles changes. But of course, the PRI has to always prove its worth to members and make a case that's positive and always look to what investors are facing now. But really importantly, what are they facing tomorrow? That needs to continue. So I think PRI has been the backbone for the industry, and I have no doubt it will continue to be. Does PRI need to think about whether it really wants to primarily be a responsible investment organisation? So by that, I mean helping investors integrate ESG, use stewardship, deploy capital responsibly into the real economy? Or does it want to be a sustainable finance organisation that's focused on shaping frameworks, taxonomies, regulations? Because to me, this is my view, they're not the same things. So responsible investment to me is about helping investors. It's not about, building frameworks and the frameworks that you operate in. I think both matters, but I don't think PRI should try to be that sort of regulatory body. I think its unique value is in helping investors. I also think just on what the PRI could play a really important role in shaping the global policy conversation, but I think that it should use its time on policy to focus less on that regulatory environment and more on how the financial system actually works. Because I still think the truth is that we all talk about being long-term investors, but we still operate in these really short-term waves, quarterly earnings, executive pay that's tied to 1 or 3 year cycles, asset managers that are judged on annual benchmarks and mandates that reward hugging the index and doesn't actually reward, taking some of the bets that need to be taken. So I think that the PRI could be really uniquely placed to tackle that because it can bring asset owners and managers together to really talk about how do we reset the financial system and the incentives and the mandates that do reward resilience and long-term value creation, not just the next quarter's numbers.
James, do you see, an organization that is needing to think of something new? Is it stalled or is it just, the normal pains of growth for an organization that's moving from a teenager to an adult?
I feel like ESG integration has probably done its thing. I mean, markets are pretty efficient. They were actually also pretty efficient when we launched, but when it comes to ESG data, when we launched, there was, the predecessor of Sustainalytics, I think it was Jansi, and they had less than 50 people. Innovest, I think, had 50, 60 people, which became MSCI, et cetera. Now, I mean, we're talking 1,000 each plus another, 10 to 20,000 people with ESG in their job title in the investment space. So I think the market for ESG alpha has grown so much that I find it hard to believe that there is really much legitimate, stock picking alpha generation potential in this market. And, as maybe we'll talk about, I think AI will make that even more difficult. Now, yes, there's a role, an ongoing role for active ownership or stewardship, but I also think the zone of discretion of corporate management has got smaller. When we launched, many companies didn't have any or certainly not large sustainability teams. And now most large caps do. And they have picked the low-hanging fruit. So it's more difficult now than it was when we launched for companies to take action that is cheap and easy and profitable and impactful. And so I think stewardship has, I think there's still some very good potential in supply chains. Again, pointing to Fiona's and my commonality, we think, frontier markets, emerging markets is really a very promising area of additional focus. But I think stewardship as well is probably reduced as a tool compared to when we launched. Where I think the PRI needs to head, and I don't know if it's possible with the current signatory representation, but it needs to shift from a sort of a collaborative engagement and policy initiative to a collaborative investment initiative. Now, a lot of the most difficult challenges in investment are frontier markets and early stage tech. Most of signatories don't do either. Why don't they do either? Because it's difficult, it's expensive, it's a pain. And if you need to deploy $10 billion in private equity, you're just not going to do, a $200 million portfolio of 10 VC funds. You're just not going to bother. So is the PRI position, and I think it is, to actually facilitate that and lower the costs of those small scale, early stage technology investments and frontier market high risk investments to the point where it could be aggregated and fit in large institutional investor portfolios. The innovative asset owners like Temasek are doing this, and I would hope that the PRI could be a catalyst for a mass adoption of these kinds of innovative early stage and frontier market, private market strategies by the bulk of PRI signatories.
Let's take this, James, and briefly play a small game. You can rewrite the principles, and there can't be more than three. You seem to have killed principle one and principle two. What are the three principles for the PRI going forward?
Well, I wouldn't kill principle two. I think there's still a role for stewardship, but it needs to be probably focused on, things that are more creative, more adventurous, funds that, invest directly in the laggards. There are very few ESG investors who are deliberately investing in fourth quartile companies to push them to improve. So I think there's still potential for stewardship. A principle which we actually did float during the drafting process, and the drafting pension funds were absolutely not willing to entertain it at the time. I have no idea whether they would be willing to now, is this idea of actually proactive, collaborative investment into solutions in private markets. Now, we put this on the table, at the time, and ESG integration, active ownership, and reporting was all we could get politically. Now, it may still be the case that no large pension funds are willing to actually commit to the types of activities that Temasek, for example, are undertaking. But I would like to think that would be the case.
Thanks, James. Fiona, principles for you need to stay, go, and if they could change, how would they?
I think worrying about changing the principles is too much, is just a distraction, right? You'd have to get the whole industry to agree again on another set. And I don't think that is what matters. I think it's what you do underneath the principles and what you have in the PRI's longer term strategy. That's really important. I still think that I agree with everything that James said, but I still think there's integration to be done. For example, how do you integrate ESG when you're looking in frontier markets, etc., or in private markets? There's some of that that's happened, but there could be more in other asset classes. So, and maybe it's not integration as we see it today, but I still think PRI's got a role in helping with investors with the sort of nuts and bolts and moving and keeping to move and innovate in those areas. So I just wouldn't be, that's not where I'd be spending my time. Like if I was still at the PRI, I would be spending my time on trying to get capital deployed.
What would you have done differently as PRI leaders at your time, knowing what you know today?
It's a really hard question, Lorenzo. So I would have done everything bigger and better and with more urgency, of course. I think I would have pushed investors harder to move beyond making commitments into real action and capital being deployed. I definitely, but I've already mentioned this. I think I would have spent a lot more time on the emerging market frontier area, definitely, and looking at developing markets. How we bring investors together to deploy capital? Could they share risk? What did we need to do to make those markets better? And the other thing that I really think I would have spent more time on is the whole issue about social media. Investors at the end of the day own a lot of those social media companies, and governments aren't regulating them or keeping them under control. The whole fueling of misinformation and that's sending all this polarization out there is just causing problems across the world. And I think I would have spent more time on what could we do as investors. And so I know we're going to talk about AI that you mentioned. One of my concerns is I think AI can be a big game changer, but let's make sure that we don't have the same problems that we're having with the tech companies in terms of no sort of guardrails around social media.
James, what would you have done differently?
Similar. I would have tried to build up our impact investing work stream far bigger and faster than we did. Now, we had it there from the beginning, and we had one person doing their best to try to build momentum. It never really got traction while I was at the PRI. It was always, and the reality is most signatories to the PRI
weren't doing any impact investing and probably still aren't. And so, you know, we didn't have a natural constituency for that type of strategy. But I think in hindsight, you know, we should have shown more leadership on that and made the case that private market impact investments in developing countries and early stage tech was really vital if we're going to solve the world's problems. And simply doing ESG integration to eke out a little bit of alpha in our equities portfolios and whatever is not really going to get us where we need to go. Because I think one of the challenges with the PRI community is that sustainable investing professionals and ESG professionals are mostly focused in liquid asset classes. And they're not able, they don't have the political capital within their organizations. They're not able to actually have a type of high-level conversation, you know, to, for example, bring together a collaboration of large pension funds. Now, there were some other parallel initiatives that were trying to do these kind of long-term infrastructure type investments and so on. None of that really worked as far as I know. And I would have, in hindsight, tried to make it work.
James, Fiona, in 2018, PRI staff went on a run and I found this t-shirt. And as you see, it references the word grit. So already the need for grit was not only about running, but it was around getting the PRI to keep going. Should the PRI in this moment of challenge of initiatives keep a grit around industry association or about being a change maker?
I think both. I don't think it's one or the other. I think an industry association with a genuine ability to lead is what I'd like to see. I think, you know, historically and certainly at the beginning, you know, we had no choice but to follow because we had our signatories and they were the members and they were, you know, on my board who I was reporting to. So we sort of had to follow what they wanted, and they're relatively conservative organizations in terms of their you know, appetite for excitement. But I think going forward, it's very well funded, you know, huge numbers of staff and resources, and I think it can afford to lose a few signatories who are not interested in a sort of a innovative collaborative investment strategy, for example. If you're just in there for a bit of branding, ESG branding, so that you can get, you know, mandates with European pension funds, well, yeah, we'll lose a bit of membership fees, but I think PRI is big enough now that it could afford to lose, you know, 20% of its signatories in order to do something truly interesting and innovative in the collaborative investment space.
Thanks, James. Fiona, I was in charge under you of keeping those signatories in. Should I let them go? Is it Changemaker or is it industry association?
I don't really see a big distinction. I think any association that's not alive to the wider change that's happening in the world and taking an active role in supporting its members in the face of that change, like as an association, just wouldn't last. I do think that PRI does have a lot of power. And as they say, when you have power, you either use it or you lose it. We took the view in the early stages, and I still think this was the right view then, that we should be a big tent and try to bring as many people along as we could. And I think that was right then. I think you could look at it now and say, as James has said, you could probably lose some of the signatories who actually aren't doing anything if they're just there for marketing. I think that's, you know, there's enough reason now, there's been enough time that they should know what they're doing. In the earlier stages, you couldn't really say that. You were trying to help bring people together and educate them. Now there's no reason. There's all, everything's there that they should possibly have. So, you know, even when I think back at that question that you were saying about what I would do differently, I think we should have been getting to that stage where we were starting to do more about not having signatories who weren't prepared to do things. So to me, as you know, Lorenzo, the asset owners were always the core and the beating heart of the PRI, and because they're the ones who give mandates at the end of the day. So I would be really trying to enhance the power of the group of the asset owners if, you know, and I think the PRI should continue to do that.
Look, I think we know that there's a lot to be done and that the PRI needs to either use it or lose it. But as an industry, with the complexities that we just flagged, can we leverage on technology and AI? And specifically, is that something that's going to help close the gap between some of the commitments and the actions that we think are needed? Or is it just going to amplify the problem given some of the risks it carries along? Starting with you, James, do you think it is this sort of savior, or is it kind of like nail in the coffin, done? We're just gonna have an impossible way ahead.
So AI should make everything cheaper. It's basically adding an element of cognitive ability into the chain that wasn't there before, which means, again, I think it will make markets more efficient, which means there's even less opportunity for ESG outperformance or leveraging ESG issues to manage risk or outperformance, which goes against, you know, the efficacy of Principle One, for example. It will also make stewardship hopefully cheaper and more effective, which could be useful. But again, as we've coming back to often, I think where the real potential is in frontier markets. There is real challenges in terms of human capital in the poorest countries in the world. If you look at education levels and so on, you know, very, very low levels of high school graduation and university graduation still in much of the developing world. And I think it's an interesting question, and this isn't necessarily, you know, PRI or investment related, but it's a very interesting question whether AI tools will get to the point in the next few years where they can start to complement and assist, you know, the talented entrepreneurs in those countries to build out businesses without having as deep a bench of talent as you would need to run an industrial enterprise. So I think there's huge potential in developing countries for AI tools to enhance productivity and, you know, management of larger enterprises with fewer highly talented entrepreneurs and that sort of thing.
So there's an element of democratization.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it basically will make everything that is currently, you know, a cognitive resource cheaper, which what we're lacking in the world in general is cognitive resource. We can solve everything if we have enough brain power, you know, thrown at it.
Great. Fiona, you sit on a number of investment boards, and how are you seeing AI being used there?
Look, I think that in all the organizations I'm involved in, they're at the early stages of really working out how to use AI and how to use it responsibly. So I think AI could be the biggest accountability tool that we have, but I do think that there needs to be guardrails around it, as I was saying. And talking of the PRI, I think this could be like a fantastic role that it could play in, as investors, what are the guardrails that we need? How do we make sure that AI is actually responsible? And that's a big, you know, systemic issue. And I think PRI could play a fantastic role in dealing with those systemic issue, because I just think that if big tech won't own the impacts of AI in the way it hasn't owned the impacts of social media, then society and investors are going to pay the price, and we need to make sure that we don't end up paying that price in the way that we have already with social media. And I think investors definitely have to get involved. And plus, we need to also be looking at the whole issue, not let us not forget about the energy that AI uses and how we manage that effectively as investors as well.
James, you mentioned before greenwashing. Can AI help, or because of all the tricks that it offers, does it just allow to better hide what investors are doing or what companies are doing?
No, I think it can definitely help. And I mean, that's a perfect example of where retail investors should, through very simple tools, be able to work out themselves whether something is aligned with their values or not, and doesn't actually need regulate it to come in and create a huge bureaucracy to protect them from, you know, their own value choices. So yeah, I think there could be some very simple AI tools that could easily be developed that would verify what is in a particular fund and see if it's aligned with your own personal values and help you make decisions and so on. And I think that is an ideal product for the free market to develop and sell to people.
Fiona, you mentioned before the big tech companies, basically the social media platforms, which in many cases are the big tech companies that are offering AI today. So you felt that they needed attention from a social media perspective. So do you think these big tech companies need to be doing something differently on AI in terms of managing the risks you mentioned earlier?
So we need to let industries begin and thrive, but we can't let them, just do whatever they like, which seems to be the way at the moment with tech companies for some reason. So getting that balance right, allowing innovation, but not innovation at any cost.
So we're heading towards the end. I think one thing I'd like to ask both of you briefly to cover is just in one sentence, is to say, what gives you hope for sustainable investments in the next decade, James?
Yeah, hope for the huge growth of private market investments into innovation. I think rolling out expensive renewables or renewables which don't have sufficient grid stability and baseload hasn't served us well. And I think we need to innovate our way out. And I want to see a lot more investment into that.
Thanks, James. Fiona, two sentences given James' length.
Well, I'm going to say something slightly contrary to James, because I think that what gives me hope is that, there has been $2 trillion invested in renewable energy and clean energy. I'm not denying that there aren't problems with the grid and we need to sort that out. But, clean energy is about to surpass coal as the major source of the world's power. And I think that gives me hope that we actually can tackle big issues.
Want to pick up on something we do on every episode, which is we ask the guests to think about a piece of art, being music, books, paintings, whatever it is that inspire you and make you connect with sustainability issues at the same time. We've had in previous episodes, songs from Elton John, Vivaldi, classical music, books that I would never touch or read. But I'd love to hear yours. Fiona, what is your sustainability piece of art?
Okay, so about 15 years ago, my mentor Mavis died, and she had these two paintings that sat side by side at her house, and she left them to me in her will because I always love them. And so one of them is three women in Victorian era clothing, because it's depicting the women in the Victorian era who are painting on a fence. And in the one that sits next to it, there are three women in the 70s in the sort of protest movement who were also writing, painting, slogans on a fence. And on one of them, it says, riding on the fence is better than sitting on the fence. And on the other, it says, but it's not much better. We have to find ways to break the fences down. And I still think that's where we are with with sustainability. Traditional ways of doing things in the finance sector still need to be challenged, and we're going to break that fence down.
James, what about you? Any sustainable art on your mind?
Well, there's a really amazing Nigerian artist called El Anatsui, who I discovered, who makes these spectacular wall-size art pieces from discarded bottle tops and waste materials. He has an exhibition in Brooklyn at the moment, and really just spectacular. And to see the level of creativity coming out of a developing country artist who is now getting success in developed world using recycled materials and really showing that our waste can actually be turned into incredible artwork based on simply one person's creativity is really inspiring.
So with this, I'd like to close. I think what we've heard from you guys is that sustainable investment is still alive and kicking, but it has different colors and different shades, and that it is keep going despite regulation, not because of it. That the PRI has done a great job in its first 20 years, but it has quite a lot to do going ahead, and that it needs to get on with it and focus on probably a different set of challenges and of ways forward compared to what it had at the beginning. And that innovation and AI can be a solution if it is properly managed against at risk, and it can help in areas where we've struggled, including in emerging markets and in other retail communications more broadly. So James and Fiona, really, I want to thank you both. You've led sustainable investments for a really long time, and you continue to share a great set of insights. And I'd like to flag and take a hold of a quite well-known saying by Isaac Newton that says, if I have seen further, it is by standing on the shoulder of giants. And I certainly feel that I have, and I'm sure the community and the industry feels the same. So with that, thanks all for listening. Thanks, Curtis File, for helping support and build this, as well as Ben and John at Earworm. If you enjoyed the episode, please like, subscribe, and comment. And see you on the next show. And until then, stay wired.